my former coach, Larry Haler, would always say, I don't treat you equally. I treat you fairly. Which means there are different rules for different people.
It's so true.
It is. That's the way life works.
I hate when people say it's to treat everybody equally. And we're talking about pro sports. It's like, no, it's not. That's not the way it goes.
You are now listening to The Waggle, the official podcast of the Canadian Football League.
Once again on The Waggle podcast, what do you know? We're going to be talking about returns. The year of the return continues. Plus on this episode, Harris versus Pruneau. Rain, go away. What do you do during yet another weather delay? Davis Sanchez, good morning. Where should we start?
How about this? So, yeah, it's been the year of the return. It's been crazy. It's some unprecedented, obviously. That's why year of the return. But the best returner of the week, or the most electrifying returner of the week, to me, was Christian Jones. And he's a guy who hasn't even been a factor the whole season. Frankie obviously got to the end zone, but the fact that, like, every time Christian Jones touched the ball, I was on the edge of my seat ready for him to break it. Like, this, just what he showed, the cuts and explosiveness that Christian Jones showed, Eskimo fans got to be excited about who they got. And it also tells me the returners in this league this year, because this is a guy that wasn't even getting touches or on the active roster. That's the kind of guy that's waiting. And these guys are electric. And it's been fun to watch.
I thought Brandon Banks was the best returner in the CFL. Like, that's a thought I had in my head. He's not even the best returner on his own team. Like, that's where we are in terms of the depth of returners in the league. That Terry Williams is a beast. Took one to the house that changed the game versus BC, a game, yet again, that they thought they had won with a double-digit lead, and then they blew it. Had another return to set up another score, and he may not have been the most impactful returner this week, because Janarian Grant goes off for 306 kick return yards and two TDs in his first CFL game. Winnipeg is just finding returners left, right, and center, evidently. Maybe it's their scheme and not the guys returning. But we've talked a lot about this podcast surmising why we're seeing so many returns. And for those who haven't listened, the numbers are crazy. In 2018, we had 15. In 2017, we had 16. In 2016, we had 13. So you can kind of see, like, where we are in terms of kick returns. This year we have 17. We're on pace for 42. Most kick return TDs in a single season is 24 in 1995. So that is going to be smashed unless something drastic changes over the next couple months of the season. We've talked about the returners, the depth, the schemes. How much of this is about the coverage and the emphasis on coverage? Dave Dickinson, whose team has been abused when it comes to returns, they had William Kelly week 6 kickoff return against 110 yards, Brandon Banks week 6 missed field goal 115 yards, and then Janarian Grant 2 punt returns 76 and 83 yards against them in week 9. And that's a club who emphasizes specials. Here's what Dave Dickinson said about his coverage unit. I want your opinion on it. He said, you can see them develop. We didn't have very many people around the ball. Mark's a great coach, so we got to figure it out. We have got to get some people who take some pride in covering kicks and make sure we are getting the job done. Now, there are some great returners, some great schemes and all that business, but a lot of the time special teams is effort, and I'm going to make sure I beat you. One-on-one battles, and obviously we lost most of those tonight. How much of this is returns, and how much is just the coverage and the coverage units?
It seems like such a simple answer. Like, I'm going to beat you. It's one-on-one, and whoever wins, which Dave's got a point. A lot of special teams is that. But once you've given up returns, and once it's been pointed out as an issue for your team, which it has for the Stamps, it's not about effort anymore. Because if you're the one that's not giving effort, you're going to get cut. So I don't think it's about effort. I think it's, to answer your question, I'm going to say it's the speed of these guys. And if there's on a CFL field as wide as it is and the opportunities guys are getting, if you find a seam as fast as these guys are, it's going to the house. It's infectious. Guys are confident, believing they could be the next one to hit one, or guys who have already hit it again. And so they're hitting the holes and they're taking shots and believing every time they touch the ball, they can score. I think it's the athletes, and I think it's the size of the field and the speed of these guys.
Has the game changed, though, where some of the great athletes aren't just career special teams guys? Like, I look around the league, and do we have a Brian Crawford? Do we have a Jeff Johnson? Do we have someone who is going to make their money for...
Brian Crawford, Jeff Johnson, I love it.
I'm just saying, like, do those guys still exist?
Jason Araki?
That's a great one. Do those guys still exist where you can make a decent amount of money for a long time
Just
Miller. Playing special teams?
Wade Miller. Here's one for you. There's one. You heard of him? No, I mean, yeah. I mean, Fraser Sopik's an example of a guy who's, you know, a young guy. I mean, he hasn't had a life on special teams because he's a rookie. But, I mean, he's a guy who's – that's what he's doing, and he's really good at it, and he's young. I think there's a lot of – of good young teamers who take pride in that. Now, to answer the question of is there the lifetime guys like Jeff Johnson and Brian Crawford – we don't know yet because those guys are, you know, there's still a bunch of young guys. But no, I don't think it's changed in that regard.
I think there are young guys playing special teams who eventually hope to be old guys playing special teams. But I think if they're going to stay in the league, they're going to play on first and second down. But maybe Ryan Jansen, who works for the league, maybe he has an answer for what's going on in terms of special teams. He definitely will have an answer on what everyone was talking about this week, the weather delay. That's coming up next on The Waggle. It's something everyone was talking about throughout the weekend, so naturally we're going to talk about it on the podcast. Davis wants answers. He wants the truth. I'm not sure if I can handle the truth. So we bring in the guy with the big title who makes the big bucks, Senior Director of Football Operations, Ryan Jansen, to answer the tough questions. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, fellas. Good to be here.
Well, I mean, you're generally going to be here when people are upset so you can set things straight. So one person who was upset was John Bowman. After the game, after the delay, he said, "It's a rule the CFL put in, and obviously we aren't happy with it. We wanted to go about it differently in negotiations, but got voted down. It's a black eye in the league. You know, it's a competitive game." And Bowman wasn't the only one, whether on social or in front of live mics, who was a bit frustrated. Take us back to the negotiation table. How did this rule come about in the first place?
Yeah, so really it started the first game of last year. If you guys remember the Edmonton-Winnipeg game in Winnipeg, the game was, we had a long rain delay, or actually a lightning delay. It was close to 3 hours. And I think we came on for a little bit, and then we had to delay a little bit longer. And it was just, it put the commissioner in a tough spot because at some point, when do you not continue that game?
Right.
And the current rules in our constitution at that point said if a game is stopped due to weather or any other environmental conditions, you play the next day.
These are last year's rules.
Those are last year's rules. And then we got thinking, and with the PA, we got thinking it's very difficult to play a game, as you guys know. Play, say, 2-3, part of a fourth quarter, stop the game, and then finish it the next day. Your body's not ready to play the next day. So it got us thinking, okay, we have to change our rules and make them less did not put Randy in a spot where he has to make a decision whether to continue or not. Let's make the rules black and white. So in the summer, throughout the summer, we developed a plan, basically a protocol working with some of the presidents. And then we presented to them and they voted last January in Mount Tremblant, all the club presidents. And we just established this protocol, which we were all on board with. And then we negotiated with the players this past spring. And there wasn't a lot of debate. I think they were happy that, you know, we're getting rid of the opportunity to having to play the next day. Let's set these ground rules that if you're off for a certain amount of time in the first part of the game, we're going to continue it another time. Or if you're off for an hour, which we established, after the halfway point of the third quarter, the game's over. And there wasn't a ton of discussion. I think maybe guys have, this was a few months ago, and nobody's really looked at it since. So maybe some of the players and some of the people have forgotten about it. But we just still think it's a great process. We do agree we're going to sit down and talk about it again this offseason, that maybe an hour is a little too short. I don't know. But let's at least talk it through with both our teams and the players.
So there is a a protocol that now there's no decision to be made, guessing involved in it. Can you kind of go over what it is exactly? You briefly mentioned it, but what it is now and how it plays out from the time perspective of the game and when a stoppage and when a replay would happen?
When the game, similar to baseball, where they have that five-inning rule, once the game's at five innings, they can stop it and whoever's leading wins. So we have that now based on halfway point of the third quarter. So once you get to the halfway point of the third quarter, we consider the game final. And if we can't finish the game after that point, whoever's winning at that point wins the game and gets the 2 points.
Which is a scenario that happened this week.
Exactly. So the issue is we established the one-hour point. As you guys know, you play for 2.5 quarters. You don't want to keep playing. If you're off for 3 hours, like that's a lot on your body. So we established it at 1 hour. Okay, you have halftime, which is 15 minutes-ish. And then once you get to the third quarter, if you're off for more than an hour, we don't think it's fair to the players to have to warm up again. So that's why we establish it at 1 hour.
And the 1 hour is only if you've played 3.5 quarters.
Correct. So if there's a stoppage, and we've had a few stoppages this year. If the stoppage is before the halfway point of the third quarter, we can actually stop it up to 3 hours and still continue that game. So our thought is maybe it's start of the first quarter and it's 5 minutes in and we have a long delay. Okay, we think the players can be off for a while, then warm up properly and continue the game. So prior to the halfway point of the third quarter, we can delay up to 3 hours and still continue the game.
So most of these delays are because of lightning, correct? Because you can play through intense rain or hail or snow.
Correct. It's all related to lightning.
And what is the amount of time that the lightning has to be clear for a lack of a better term?
We typically, we deal with our league meteorologist on this. So we have a weather station at every stadium. And that'll tell us when there's a lightning strike. Basically, we'll get a warning when it's within 25 kilometers of the stadium, if it's within 17, and then when it's within 10. When it's within 10 kilometers of the stadium, we immediately stop the game. No questions asked. We make a quick call to the supervisor, to the official, and then the players are cleared within seconds. When it's within 25 and 17, then what we do is we call the meteorologist, and they will advise us whether the storm is coming quickly, whether they think we can keep playing a little bit longer. So really we lean on their expertise, whether we stop the game when lightning is on its way. And then once we've had a stoppage, we deal with them on the timing of when we can return to play. So we'll get a notification when there hasn't been any lightning within 17 kilometers of the stadium within a 15-minute period. So we'll get a notification. But we also want to talk to the meteorologist to see are there more storms coming? Are there other cells? Are there other... And that's what we ran into in Montreal, was that we were in the middle of a storm cell. Even though lightning wasn't happening at that exact moment when we were stopped, it could have at any point. And that's why we didn't feel it was safe to continue the game.
Yeah, because I think many of the questions people had was not so much that the game was stopped or that the game was ended, it was just that it was an hour. Because a lot of those stoppages end up being longer than an hour, so the hour being the arbitrary number, once you get to that point, aren't you going to end most of those games? How much of this calculation is about kind of the competitive balance and relative to the safety of the players, relative to the safety of the fans, relative to your TV partners having these long windows of games? When you went through the process of coming up with this protocol, how did you balance all those factors?
Well, obviously there's a lot of stakeholders, like you said, TSN, players, teams, fans. So I just want to touch on a little bit the 3 hour break prior to the halfway point of the third quarter. So I'll explain a little bit better. It's a little confusing, but there is some thought put behind it.
The fans of the Waggle are an extremely intelligent bunch, RJ, so we'll get it.
They'll get it. So if we have a stoppage and it's the second quarter and the stoppage is longer than 3 hours, we are not going to continue the game. We're going to cancel the game. So there's a couple scenarios that play out. One is if we stop the game, say in the second quarter, we have a calculation based on a team winning the game 97% of the time based on the score in the certain quarters. So if Team A is winning by 21 points in the first quarter, 17 or more points in the second quarter, or 13 or more points in the third quarter, that team is going to win the game 97% of the time based on our historical stats of the last 50 years. So if we stop the game and it's a three-hour lightning delay, we're not going to continue. And if the score is more than one of those within the quarter, so we're in the second quarter, Team A is winning by 28 points, okay, game is over, 2 points awarded to that leading team. Okay, so there's that option there. If those teams play again in the current year, and we've found that a lot of these storms obviously happen this summer when there's a lot of convective activity, 80% of the games we have leading into Labor Day, those teams will play again in the current year. So that's good for us based on this, what we're calling a shootout, a weather shootout. So if we stop the game, 3 hours delay, we're not going to play again, and the score isn't at that level, so it's first quarter, we're not above 21 points, and those teams play again, we're going to have a shootout prior to their next game. And this shootout is a two possession. Each team gets two possessions prior to the actual start of the next game. And the little twist on it is, if Team A is winning 20-10 when the game is stopped, both teams start at the 55, but you actually count the number of points you have and add that to the yards towards the opposing team's end zone. So if Team A is winning 20-10, they would start both possessions at the 35-yard line. Team B would start both possessions at the 45-yard line going in. And whoever wins those two possessions, forget about the score, the previous score, whoever wins that two-possession game gets the 2 points. If it's tied from those two possessions, it's 1 point each. And then once that's done, then they start their next game.
Basically, if you're up by 10 points, you're getting the advantage to move the ball closer, yep, which is back to the probability of you being up 10 points.
Exactly.
That's how it's all
closer
mapped
to the end
out?
Zone, obviously closer, right, for a field goal, right, attempt, just helping you a little bit. And on the 20% of those games in the summer where those teams don't play again and the score isn't at that automatic win margin, then both teams just get a point and it's a tie game, regardless of the score. So it is confusing, but as you guys say, you guys will have understood this.
Well, I mean, I think it's easy for people to understand because it's black and white, and we love certainty. But I think it's difficult for people to understand because they also love competition, right? It's at the heart of the sport. And in the process of coming up with this rule, and you mentioned it's in constant evaluation, and you may address it in the future, was there ever thought to maybe leave a little bit more gray and maybe not absolve the commissioner of all power to change things, because context matters. If there's a lightning strike when a team is on the 1 yard line, if there's a game where there's playoff implications, where, you know, someone is about to break a record and it may impact their salary or earnings. Was there any thought of maybe let's give us a loophole to get out of what is black and white?
The problem was that's the way it was, and it was very difficult because we've had quite a few stoppages over the last few years, and I've been here a long time, and 10 years ago we had a stoppage every few years. Now we're having stoppages, and this is our third, but our fourth game really impacted by lightning this year. We've also had a bunch of games where there's lightning within the 17 kilometers, but we've been advised we don't need to stop the game because it's not a real threat to the stadium. So with global warming, things have changed, and we're dealing with this a lot more. So it was really gray in the past, and the issue is, and you're in the commissioner's chair, and you have to make a decision. The team that's winning says, no, it's too much lightning. We don't want our players to play. The team that's losing, oh no, the weather's fine. We want our guys to play. And so he's got to make that tough decision, and he's going to make somebody upset and somebody happy. The black and white protocol here is he just holds up this protocol agreed to by the teams, the players. Mm-hmm. Sorry, guys, my hands are tied. This is what's agreed to, and I don't have to make this tough decision because it's not fair to him. So there'll always be questions around this, especially a new protocol, but I think as people get used to it and understand it a little bit better, I think everybody should be able to live with it.
Well, thanks for helping us understand it. Basically, it's not the league's fault, the commissioner's fault. It's global warming's fault.
Exactly.
So buy electric cars and recycle, and we shouldn't have these issues anymore. Thanks for setting us straight, Ryan.
Thanks, guys.
Ryan Jansen, so smooth, so good with words. I wish I could be him when I grow up. Another guy who's really smooth, both on and off the field, and his head is smooth, got a bald head like you, has probably been going to Sport Clips. That's John Cornish. And before we get to our convo with John Cornish, let's talk a little bit about Sport Clips. I mean, this podcast, each and every week, is brought to you by our friends at, yeah, you guessed it, Sport Clips. They're known for the Sport Clips MVP haircut experience, which includes massaging shampoos, hot steam towels, sports on TV like football, hockey, baseball, basketball. But let's be honest, you're only watching football. And the legendary haircuts. You can book your appointment online at sportclips.ca or just walk in, come through. You're in no rush. Watch the sports. Even if there is a weather delay, we got you at Sport Clips. Well, no further delay. The man is a Hall of Famer. He should wait no more. On the Waggle, here is the best Canadian running back of all time, maybe. No disrespect to Andrew Harris. Here's John Cornish.
One of the new members of the Hall of Fame, but an old name and face to CFL fans, John Cornish. And first of all, congrats on being brought into the Hall. But let's talk about your bust to start things. When you first see the depiction of you that's going to last the test of time, your thought was what?
Accurate, I think. I don't really have too much to work with in terms of hair. So there was a few sort of two veins over the temples, which are, I think are reflective of the way I actually look. I thought the nose and the cheeks were good. Like honestly, when I see it, I see myself. And I think that's all you can ask for from a bust.
Well, there's been some bad ones over the years, so glad that the Hall got yours right, because there's no going back. But you are going in as a running back, as a Canadian running back, something that is few and far between. What does that distinction mean to you?
The first of all, having the opportunity to play in the CFL was I mean, you know, I'm not sure I would have had the same chances I would have had in the CFL, in the NFL. I was very thankful to the CFL for that. But, you know, there wasn't too many players with opportunities to become the star. And thanks, Peters, for sort of giving me the guidance, letting me know what the headwinds were in becoming the Canadian running back, how good I had to become the starter. So they really laid out the path for me. I'll always remember my first meeting with Coach Huffnagel. And he said, John, if you want to be a starter in this league, you have to be able to block. And this was 2008. So a year after I'd spent one year in the CFL. And basically understanding all that, I think I made the steps necessary to become the guy. But, you know, it was a long process. I was behind Joffrey Reynolds, and that took 4 years to sort of, you know, get on the field, and then a few more months to take over the job. So, you know, there was a long process, but because the Stampeders laid out the plan, I was able to execute that.
So kids now, it would be weird to them to think, well, as a Canadian, why can't I play running back? I see John Cornish going to Hall of Fame. I see Andrew Harris being the best pound-for-pound back in the league. When you were growing up, the conversation was entirely different. Who did you look up to as a young running back growing up in Canada?
Obviously Mike Pringle, Mike Clemens. It was it was cool to see them play and dominate. And then looking south, seeing Barry Sanders and Eddie George. So basically, I would say I liked sort of the opposite end of the spectrum in both the NFL and CFL. And that's why I tried to model my career after. Rather than being some hard-hitting back. I know everybody wants to put me in some kind of class. I don't really feel that I was ever some smasher. It's more about time and being able to be in the right place at the right time than anything else. And that applies both in life as well as football and running back position, as well as, you know, receiver position. But understanding where you have to be on the field is the most important part. So I modeled my career after – after those guys I mentioned, and sort of just tried to incorporate my own learnings over time.
You are known for what you did, you know, 7 yards deep, running the ball. But people at this point probably forget you were a dominant special teams player, both in Canada and before that in the NCAA. Why was that? That's just your mentality as someone who wanted to contribute to the football team, just your mentality as someone who clearly had no fear. How did that part of your game develop?
You know, my very first special teams practice, I think all the way back to grade 8, and the day before the game, we had a special teams practice. So what is this? What is this special teams? I am very interested in this. Could we have every practice as special teams? I mean, as a sprinter, I mean, I would say first and foremost, that was the thing I succeeded at, was sprinting back in the track days. Sort of taking that, having the ability to run 40 yards, get up to full speed, and then smash somebody, yes, that was something that I always took great pride in. Now, there was one team I didn't really like, punt return. But apart from that, I loved special teams so much. Even on the field goal unit, being able to hold a line with your buddies so your other buddy could kick a ball. Like, it seems so simplistic, but there's something about special teams that I always loved. And I think was the prospect that, you know, we all had to hold it down for each other. And when you can have that on a special teams unit, that's kind of camaraderie. Yeah, you have offensive players, defense players, and some special teams only players. But when they all come together on one unit, that's, for me, the best times.
Yeah, that is the essence of football, holding it down for each other. But literally on special teams, running, tackling, hitting, breaking tackling, you want to find a good football player, just look for a good special teams player. But what was it about punt returns that you weren't feeling?
Yeah, I didn't like blocking somebody 10 yards down the field and continuing to block them. With that said, I did make my name for myself in college. We had a special team stat sheet. And it kept track of all of your knockdowns, all of your good blocks, all of your tackles, everything that you could be doing on special teams. And as a statistically driven person, that fascinated me. So my very first year playing, so I took a redshirt freshman. I played a few games, but then took a redshirt freshman year. Then the following year, they came out with the stat sheet. I needed to dominate that stat sheet, and that's what I did for the following 2-3 years. Special teams punt return, I continued to dominate the stat sheet on that. There was one play where I drove my guy into the stands, and then I came back and I hit a guy immediately in front of the punt returner. Both of those guys needed to be carted off the field or carried off the field. I don't like hitting people or hurting people. However, in the moment when you got to do what you got to do, and with acceleration and force, you can control people, and that was one aspect of punt return that I did like. But in all honesty, I actually with another one, we had a punt return touchdown in the Fort Worth Bowl. This was a game that I had 144 yards combined, 2 touchdowns, but I was on that special teams unit. And I made sure that my guy didn't get off the line of scrimmage. Now, with all that said, it changed once I got to Canada. Some of the things that I could do, like smashing a guy that was 20 yards off the ball, I got flags for that, right? So I couldn't be as aggressive as I wanted to be. And because of that, I really did not like seeing my name on the special teams depth chart at any point during my CFL career.
You mentioned being motivated by the statistics, and you have a beautiful mind when it comes to numbers. You're pretty much the Rain Man of the CFL era. When you played academically, you didn't have to play football to have a career post-secondary. Why did you choose to, when there were so many other avenues in life that you could have been just as well off, if not more?
I mean, that's not a question I ever really contemplated. The idea was that I would get my degree and continue to work on myself sort of in the business world. And that's what I did, right? Football was a long-term, temporary, I don't want to say distraction, but something to do. I think with the success that I had at all the levels, it just made sense that I would continue to see how far I could take it. And for that reason, when I got down to college, they said I couldn't take computer science. because there was an engineering class in the afternoon during practice time. And scholarship athletes weren't really allowed to get into engineering for whatever reason. And because of that, I wasn't able to pursue my career path as I originally foresaw it as a, you know, computer science developer, whatever. But, you know, I ended up getting into psychology. You know, if I can't get into a computer and work with that kind of computation, then I'll work on how the mind works. And in all honesty, that sort of fed my desire to improve in the game. As I started learning more and more about sports psychology, I really think that that is actually one. I don't mention it very much, but I do believe sort of, let's call it metaprogramming, the stuff I put into preparing for the game, the sort of steps that I took in getting ready for a game, I tried to create a process that would both be relevant on the football field as well as relevant outside of the football field. I take pride in my financial planning skills, and that was because of the planning that I had to put into football. So I do think that I've managed to make it work both academically and in the business world through football, through using football as a means to an end.
Given that psychology background and just your curious nature, I'm interested to get your perspective on how you think the athlete, the football player, has changed from, let's say, 2007 when you broke into the league to even 2015 by the time you're ending your career to now as we are in 2019. Has the challenges and really the realities of the athlete changed?
I don't think the requirements of the athlete on the football field have changed nearly as much, if at all, compared to the responsibilities outside the game. Building your own brand, having a social media presence, not embarrassing yourself on social media, and really conducting yourself in the community in a way that you aren't going to be seeing anything on social media about yourself. Those are the key factors that completely different. I mean, when I was playing in 2012, 2013, 2014, that was right at the start of Instagram, the Twitter really getting good fan base or good user bases. And for me, I was able to sort of comment just at the start of all that. And in all honesty, I was able to just play football, do some media appearances, do some community appearances. And I didn't need to worry about anything else. And I appreciated that. Like, I was on Twitter and there wasn't too many people on Twitter, so I could say whatever I wanted. That is no longer the case.
What also is no longer the case is, sadly, the value of the running back. As people start to analyze the game and the game changes, not just in the passing league of the CFL, but also in the NFL, it seems like we're seeing more and more running backs by committee. We're seeing less and less premier dominant running backs. I said to the co-host of The Waggle a couple weeks ago when we were talking about you going into the Hall, how many current running backs are going to be Hall of Famers? Andrew Harris, and that's probably it. Sadly, when we were growing up, the running backs were the stars of the game. As you've seen the position that you love and you played and made fun sort of erode, and what's your perspective on it?
There was a simple rule change. First the CFL did it, then the NFL did it. The 5 yard, after 5 yards, no contact on the receiver. What that does is it both increases the likelihood of a pass interference call if there is contact, but then also makes the receiver be able to get open easier. And between those two things, it made the passing game that much more efficient. And because of that, the running game less efficient. I mean, the reality is, in my mind, 2014 was sort of the changeover year. When I came back to play in 2015, the running back position was done, right? Like, in the CFL, hey, you can get some hard yards. I actually think the Stampeders, having Jerome Messam in 2016-2017, really was able to make them have that passing attack from Bo stay as strong as it had been. But then they had that nail or sort of the hammer when they needed it. Versus sort of now you're seeing, well, we have four running backs who are effectively the same shape and size with the Stampeders at this point. So there has been a monumental shift. I mean, it's a position I think you can slot people into a lot easier. And you have a dominant player like Andrew Harris, but like you said, there's nobody else in the league right now getting that many carries, staying healthy through that many carries, and then sort of having consistent output on a weekly basis. That you used to see that across the board, but we saw running back averages, average per season, drop off. We had Corey Sheets and I in 2013, but we had a gang of other running backs. I go back further, and there's like four or five running backs above 1,000 yards every season, and now we're barely seeing one or two. So, yeah, dramatic shift in the game in that regard.
I wonder how much that played into, if at all, your decision at that time to leave the game. I mean, I said earlier you didn't need to play in the first place. You did as a distraction, as you say, and a Hall of Fame-level distraction. And so as you exited the league and the sport after 9 years, which for most is very long, your decision at that point to preserve some health, the direction of the position in the sport, or just other challenges, how do you look back at that time and your appraisal on what you've been able to do in the time since?
Well, this is the first time this topic has come up in the conversation. I'm very glad you bring that up. It did factor into my decision. After, like I said, the 2015 season, the dramatic shift in how offenses were run in the CFL, I felt like a dinosaur, right? Despite all my capabilities and ability to play and all that, I felt like this was no longer the league that I would find success in, the dramatic level that I had previously. So that did play a small factor. Yeah, people mentioned health and concussions, but the reality was I did have a arbitrary endpoint for my career, which was 2015. And I chosen that based off of what I had accomplished in 2012, 2013, 2014. Literally, you win the rushing title in half a season. What else is there more to accomplish? I mean, for me, that's my sort of football crowning achievement right there. So I had done everything I needed to do. 2015 was the year that I could see, could I get past 2000? And obviously that didn't work out. So at that point, it was okay. Everything had been done, and I chose to stop. Not everybody has sort of their plan in place to leave the game elegantly. For me personally, I started working at the bank, became an advisor, gained enough experience that I could join a wealth group, and then just sort of continue to build my career from there. But not everybody has that. So they don't choose the end date. And because of that, they don't necessarily have the smooth transition. Like I stepped away from the game, had my retirement press conference, and showed up to work, my new office, the following day. That was years in the making. And to be able to do that, sort of have all my finances in place and whatnot, there's not many people that sort of take time to lay out those steps for themselves, execute upon those steps. Like there's a point in time where I was studying for the Chartered Financial Analyst exam, working as a financial advisor in the bank, and working out to prepare for the football season. Right, there's a lot of effort put into that, but because that effort was put in, I was able to just, without concussions, without sort of the way the game was going, just make a decision that I was going to go and do this other thing now.
Yeah, for the vast majority of players, the game is done with them before they're done with the game. And if you wanted, even if you weren't a tailback in the way you were in 2014, you had the mind and the hands to be able to transition and play slot like pinball did and continue to play. But you stepped away. And now that you look back at your time in the game, lastly, before we let you go, what did you get from the game? What are some of the lessons and some of the experiences that you took from that time that you continue to utilize in your post-football career?
More generally, football taught me how to be a good teammate, to see that your teammates need you and for you to rise to the occasion, or even helping them rise to the occasion, which I found was more effective in the long term. The idea that football is the ultimate team sport, I think, is true. And the number one thing I hear from retirees is that recapturing that camaraderie in the locker room in some other place is nearly impossible. So that's the piece that I learned to respect and take and apply in my normal life. But more specifically in the CFL, once things started getting serious, like when I came into the starter role, I needed to find ways to manage my own capabilities, right? Like if you're tired, or your body's tired? How do you prepare each week to take 20 big hits? How do you prepare each week to memorize 100 plays, right? Taking that preparation, it's applicable anywhere. I've always just called it, in my code name for this, just prep time, very simple. But that's the number one thing. Like, if you have the ability to prepare and prepare in a sort of regimented, controlled way, I use checklists at work, for example. If you can apply that, take what you took from football and apply it to anything else, it's easy. Everything else becomes easy because you always have a plan. You always have a sort of set of contingencies so you can deal with anything that comes up. It makes life pretty simple. My wife and I always joke about life being easy. But, like, it's only easy now because we put those steps of preparation into place. And I thank the CFL and the Stampeders and my people we played against and my teammates for helping me become the best John Cornish football player I could become. Because if it wasn't for all those organizations, my family, the people I met along the way, the people I worked with at the bank, I wouldn't have gotten to the point where, you know, let's look at 2014, where I could elevate my teammates, come prepared for every game, and be mentally so prepared that my average per carry is 7.8 yards per carry, and then win a Grey Cup at the end of it all, after having the best player in my career in that year. Like, for me, that was 2014 was the ultimate sort of crystallization of everything I had put together previously, and it was all because of having the plan. And that's what I do now. So it works out well.
No question. And, you know, for CFL fans, it was easy to watch you and be entertained by you on the field, and very easy to listen to you afterwards and be educated by you and when you're talking off the field. So thank you for that. Continued success. All the best. And, you know, I think if you were so interested, we could be talking to future Commissioner Cornish if we're not talking to future Prime Minister Cornish. You've done so well for yourself. So thank you for being such a great ambassador for the game.
Thank you very much for having me on.
The thing I love about John Cornish, beloved by the fans, beloved by the media like me because he's so good and so eloquent, beloved by his teammates, still to a man, those guys rate him. And he's not the prototypical football guy. Being loved by your teammates, it's a badge of honor.
I know where you're going, DJ.
Unfortunately, we had some news a little bit messy. Some tea was spilled in an article by Tim Baines of Post Media. Why is Trevor Harris not still a red black? It's about more than money. And normally I say follow the money. Maybe follow Mr. Pruneau, who's a former teammate, although played on the defensive side of the ball. In said article, here's what Antoine Pruneau said about his former quarterback. It doesn't make Harris a bad person, but I didn't like the fact sometimes he was pointing fingers at other guys. He went on to say, sometimes it's tough to expose yourself to critics. I've always been my toughest judge, so I expect teammates to be the same way. Look at yourself first. If you have something to say, keep it down low. Listen, I love when people are honest, especially when they're athletes, because most of the time they just give us cliches. But I do find it ironic that in criticizing Trevor Harris, Pruneau says, don't point fingers, look at yourself, keep it on the down low. He's pointing a finger, he's not looking at himself, and he's not keeping it on the down low. But I am here for it. When you saw these comments, your first reaction was what?
Wow. Shots fired. You can't just take one man's opinion or his thoughts, his quotes, and make it the truth, because it's not fair to Trevor Harris. It's not fair to his legacy or whatever it may be, but it's not fair for we don't know what Antoine Pruneau, and it's not responsible to assume by what Antoine Pruneau said that Trevor Harris wasn't a good teammate or wasn't good in the locker room. So that's the one thing that I'll say off the top. The next thing is, from what I hear, there's no rift between those two personally. And Antoine Pruneau, what I deduct from him historically, he's a well-respected guy. He's a leader. He's never been one to just spout off for no reason. So it makes me lean to thinking there are some truths to that, or there's some validity to that. There's some feelings that maybe Trevor didn't do or lead the way some would like their quarterback to lead. I won't say the right way, but maybe how some would expect or want. And it sure was an eyebrow raising comment for sure. I heard the comment right before the game and was working the game and could not wait to see Trevor Harris' response and also the Red Blacks' response.
Well, you mentioned Trevor Harris' response. Before I respond, here's what Trevor Harris had to say first before the game.
Trevor, there was some criticism directed at you coming out of your former locker room. Are you aware of it? What's your reaction to it?
Don't have one.
Okay. Was you surprised at all to see something like that at this point?
Very, but I don't have a reaction.
And then after the game.
You said all week long that it was no big deal facing your old teammates, but after being out here against them, how was it for you?
I'm an Eskimo, man. I know that a lot of people might not think that I mean that. That was a past life, and, you know, I'm thankful for the Ottawa's organization, but, you know, they're doing their thing, and we're doing ours.
Basically nothing. He wasn't saying anything. He was keeping
it. How do you say?
On the low. I mean,
What would you say?
I mean, I think he did his talking with his right arm. He went 33 of 40 for 327 on Pruneau's head as a safety. I think that's how he did his talking. And speaking of talking, Bill Parcells said this in the NFL. My former head coach, Larry Haler.
You played for Bill Parcells?
I did not.
Oh.
There was a comma and a pregnant pause in between.
Me.
My former coach, Larry Haler, would always say, I don't treat you equally. I treat you fairly, which means there are different rules for different people. And
is that a Bill Parcells quote? Yeah. I don't treat you equally, I treat you fairly.
That's correct.
So true.
It is. That's the way
so
life
true.
Works.
I hate when people say it's to treat everybody equally, and we're talking about pro sports. It's like, no, it's not. That's not the way it goes.
Right. And so for Pruneau, the way he needs to comport himself in the locker room, the way he needs to handle himself, isn't necessarily the same as Trevor Harris, because Trevor Harris, one, is a star. Two, Pruneau is a role player. So, yeah, I think you're willing to put up with some things from Trevor Harris because your boy can sling it. And if there was an issue with him that was that deep, Greg Ellingson and Sir Vincent Rogers wouldn't have put their hand up and say, I'm willing to
come
go across the country and play with this guy.
Right.
And when you look at, no disrespect to the quarterbacks that they have in that room, they could be the best guys in the world. Could buy donuts for everybody on Monday. They could ask you about your family, how they doing. Ultimately, are you helping us win? Yes or no? We're not trying to sit around here and play kumbaya. We're trying to stack those W's and go to the playoffs and get
real
that playoff
top.
Bonus.
Real talk.
So do I think Trevor Harris was probably prickly at times? Do I think Pruneau was lying? No. Do I think ultimately it matters? And most people in Ottawa wish Trevor Harris was a quarterback right now? Yes. So that's what I take for it. But I'm here for the real talk. But I also respect Harris for speaking with his read progression and not his mouth. I'm going to try and throw you off your game, which is tough. But before we get to things that may be a little bit objectionable, let's take some time to holler at our friends from Swoop Airlines. Because listen, CFL fans, there's a new airline in the game. Swoop is Canada's ultra-low fare airline and are giving you fans the opportunity to win a round trip. That's right. Two flights to anywhere Swoop flies with their hashtag Swoop Me Away contest. Davis flies a lot, so he may want to listen. All you have to do is head to the @FlySwoop, that's @FlySwoop, on their Instagram or Facebook, and follow the instructions on their latest post. Do it now. Don't forget to tag your fellow CFL fan who you'd like to take on your trip. Maybe you got a little shorter, you want to come with it. Maybe it's a trip for the boys. Make sure you hashtag them. Hashtag Swoop Me Away. Check out www.flyswoop.com to book your next flight. That'd be dope going to a CFL city. Anywhere the Swoop flies with a homie or a homette, maybe a little bachelorette party.
I'm going somewhere warm.
You're always going somewhere.
You can keep the football game. I'm going to somewhere warm. I'm going to a beach. Swoop, where do you go? Where do you go? There's nice sand.
I'm going to Touchdown Atlantic, right? There's got to be some nice beaches on the.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
On the East Coast.
Definitely there is, for sure.
Let's talk about Canada a little bit, and I like to stump Davis. So I did some Canada basketball interviews.
Okay.
I don't know if you heard, our basketball team is trying to qualify for the Olympics via the World Cup this summer, except none of the best players are playing. But that's not the point. Of the players that are playing, I interviewed them and I asked them a question because they're well-traveled playing the NBA, the NCAA, in Europe. What is the dumbest question about Canada you have gotten in your travels? And you're someone who's represented this country, playing abroad and representing this country, just backpacking and traveling. The dumbest question. I'll tell you what theirs is after you give me yours.
I'm going to go with distance. I'm going to go with distance. I can't think of any particular question. The one thing that amazes me, I would say, is distance that they don't realize. Like, for example, New York from Ontario or Vancouver from Seattle is the big one for me. There, when they realize that it's 15 minutes from the Washington border to Canada, and they think that it takes 3 days to get from Washington to Canada. So that's, I'm gonna just say that they're completely oblivious to the proximity of the two countries, knowing that it's a border, that they're bordering countries.
Right. There is a sense of aloofness from many Americans to what goes on outside of their borders, which is why I love the fact that every year hundreds of Americans come and ply their trade here in Canada playing football. So they learn about the culture. They bring that information back. The Canada basketball guys, to a man, many of them said this. They are still asked, I mean, still, you should have never been asked this, but they are asked, do you live in an igloo?
Don't really get asked that. I think they just answered that for you.
All of them to a man without knowing what the other answers are. Listen, I went to school in Buffalo, which is not far on the other side of the border. Like, we share the same time, the same climate, everything. And when I was doing orientation, a young lady asked me seriously, oh, you're from Canada. Where did you park your canoe? And I'm not good at any water sports. I don't have a cottage. I don't like to canoe or fly fish or do anything close to water. That was a real question. So, no, I'm not surprised. Listen, let us know, our many Canadian listeners and Canadian players in the league, what's the dumbest question about Canada you've gotten? Something else that's dumb that happened this week. Antonio Brown, wide receiver of the Pittsburgh Steelers, the dumbest thing that happened to him was not the fact that he can't play football because he had chiropathy on his feet, which gave him frozen feet, literally. He is threatening to retire from the game of football because he can't use his former helmet, which is no longer certified. He is not willing to choose from the 27 styles of helmet that are certified. He tried to paint his Steeler helmet silver and get away with it. Now, I think people don't understand how much a football player loves their equipment and their helmet, but even your playing days, did you have an affinity that strong to a piece of equipment that it was going to change the way you play?
I always wore a low helmet, meaning I always wanted my helmet to be low and not rising up, because you look fun. It was all about aesthetics for me. I just wanted. I had the Dion.
Not about vision. Not about concussion protocol.
No, nothing. No. I wanted to look.
Not about ventilation.
I didn't even used to buckle my helmet up when I played. I would buckle one strap up because everything was Dion. Dion had the double bar face mask. I had the double bar face mask. I had one strap off, and that was actually, I wore one strap for a long time until Mark Trespin came and was like, snap up your helmet. And I'm like, this is how I wear my helmet. No, snap up your helmet. And the Tress was very adamant about snapping up your helmet just for whatever reason. Anyway, the helmets for comfort, you wanted something that, almost like a hat, as DJ's wearing a hat right now. You wear your hat low because that's your comfort. It feels comfortable to have it snug on your head. That's how I wanted my helmet to be nice and low and not rise. You don't see these guys with the big Mr. Potato Head helmets that rise up. That was the only thing that, from a helmet standpoint, that I cared about. But Antonio Brown is complete, to me, lack of awareness. Like, do you really think that there's, I don't know how many thousand guys in the NFL right now, and none of those guys, everyone has to change their helmet except for you? Like, what? Where in the world do you think that? And then he actually appeals it, thinking he has any chance to win. Have all the conversation about the NFL, the billion dollar business, and the financial ramifications that are coming with head injuries, and it doesn't make any sense that he would even think that he could even have this conversation. Clueless.
Oh, I agree. I mean, Tom Brady won 4 Super Bowls with one helmet. He's changing his. The technology with helmets now is so good that companies will mold the helmet to your head, which it can't be better than that if you take the time. He's not willing to do that. But the crazy thing is not that he expects the rule to be changed because of him. The fact that he's threatening to leave $30 million guaranteed on the table for a helmet. Man, I'd play with no helmet for $30 million guaranteed.
He's not leaving nothing on the table.
No, you're right. He's about business is booming, and he's about that money. This has been fun. Thanks, Paul.